Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Monday morning. It's August 11th. Currently 56 degrees and sunshine here in Old Town Park City. 54 degrees reported in the Heber Valley. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center. Welcome back to meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Happy Monday. It's time for a look at your Wasatch Back forecast on this Monday. It's back to school for many folks, and we're looking at lots of sunshine. The weather is not going to be an issue, at least with any precipitation chances as we go throughout today. Your Monday afternoon will feature highs climbing into the lower 80s in Park City as we go throughout the afternoon hours, with highs in the upper 80s to right around 90 for the Heber Valley. As we go into your Tuesday, you guessed it, more sunshine, but we've got this heat dome, this high pressure ridge that's just to our west, is going to begin to shift back to the east, and that means it's going to be sitting on top of us. So we are expecting a big warm-up. So for the Heber Valley, look for those temperatures to climb back into the low to mid-90s by the time we get towards your Tuesday afternoon. We'll be seeing those temperatures climbing into the mid to upper 80s for our friends in Park City as we go throughout your Tuesday afternoon. By Wednesday, look for lots of sunshine. High temperatures will climb to about 90 degrees for us as we go throughout the afternoon hours in Park City. We'll look at those highs in the mid-90s in the Heber Valley. Overall, look for mostly sunny skies to be expected. Now, as we get towards the second half of the week, we're still going to be looking at mostly sunny to partly cloudy skies for your Thursday and Friday. But the high pressure will shift enough to where we may see just a little bit of monsoon moisture try to sneak in. Now, it's still questionable if that's going to provide us with any real measurable rainfall. But I will say there is a slight chance of a few isolated showers and thunderstorms popping up as we get into our Thursday and Friday afternoons. Again, not going to be widespread, not going to be a washout. By any means, don't cancel your outdoor plans. Just a chance of a few isolated showers and storms popping up as we get towards the end of the week, with maybe tapping into some slight monsoon moisture. Otherwise, as we go into the weekend, that high pressure ridge reestablishes itself, which means we start to dry things back out again. Overall, temperatures will start off by Thursday in the mid 80s for Park City and near 90 in the Heber Valley, and we'll start to cool it down just a little bit. We're talking highs only in the low 80s as we get towards your Friday, Saturday, and Sunday for Park City, and highs in the mid to upper 80s for the Heber Valley. Let's look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Stay tuned. In just a minute, we'll be checking in with Summit County Health Department Director Phil Bondurant. Later on, event organizer Nancy Major with details about the V Foundation, an upcoming fundraiser for cancer research. And Peace House Executive Director Kendra Wyckoff in with details about the organization's 30th anniversary and the brand refresh happening. Taking a look at some local news from last week, Park City mayoral candidates say they would bring decisive leadership and a culture change to City Hall if elected to serve the community. KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports.
Ryan Dickey and Jack Rubin addressed voters in back-to-back speeches at a Monday forum hosted by the League of Women Voters and the Proactive Alliance at the Park City Library. It was the first time the men discussed their candidacies at the same public event. Both spoke for about 5 minutes following speeches from the 8 candidates running for Park City Council. As mayor, Jack Rubin said he wants to represent residents.
It's the voice of the people that's missing here. We've got a lot of very well-organized groups in town, whether it's Historic Main Street, the resorts, developers, you name it. There's a number of very well-organized groups. What's missing, I think, is our voice. It's time that somebody comes to the council and represents those who are not organized, the residents, the taxpayers.
Rubin, who had a career in finance, said he has an advantage as an outsider who hasn't held elected office in Park City. The Park Meadows resident said issues like the Sundance Film Festival leaving town and finding a new headquarters for Recycle Utah could have been different if the city had been more proactive. Rubin said many voters have discussed traffic as a top concern. He questioned the city's process to create new code that would allow for more density in the Bonanza Park neighborhood.
But if we can't get around town now, why would we want to encourage development to further add to the load of traffic here until we have a plan to address traffic and circulation? And frankly, I think it's being done backwards. We've got to figure out how to get people around town first before we worry about pumping more traffic in through the two arteries or figuring out how to keep them out.
Rubin said he wants to lead City Hall with a focus on efficiency and transparency.
I don't have a magic bullet. I'd love to tell you that I do. What I do have, and I've done this throughout my career, is lead meetings where open discussions are held, where all facts are presented. I've attended city council meetings where I've listened to public comment, followed by the debate of the council, then followed by a vote. And like, oh my goodness, how did that vote come out of that discussion? Clearly, facts, all the facts are not being presented.
The other mayoral candidate, Ryan Dickey, referenced some of his campaign talking points from his city council race 2 years ago. Those included affordability, maintaining historic character, and protecting the environment. As the owner of a local HOA management firm with two children, Dickey also said he's focused on the challenges facing Park City's workforce and declining enrollment at local schools. Dickey said there are issues elections and leadership elections. He said this year's race is a leadership election for two reasons.
One is, when it comes to leadership, there's the where. Where are we going? Where are we trying to lead the community? And that's an important question to answer. That's all these things you heard about tonight, all these opportunities before the council. We don't have to go boil the ocean to find them. They're here before us now, waiting for the council to make decisions. So that's part of the leadership in leading this council, leading this next council, to have political courage, to make affirmative decisions, to move Park City forward.
Dickey, who also lives in Park Meadows, said the other tenet of leadership is understanding how to manage City Hall.
And the second piece of that leadership is the how. How do we lead? How do we lead this organization that works for us, that works for all of us as a city, to create a culture of the city that's positive, that incentivizes innovation and risk-taking, and staff that aren't paralyzed in their roles by criticism and a lack of direction, but that will stick their neck out for us, our people. We want them to take risks and bring us opportunities and say, no, there's another way to do it.
Dickey echoed some of the comments made by other candidates, saying that a culture change is needed in city council chambers.
Create that culture at the city that we can be proud of, and a culture that when you come before us as a council and a mayor, we heard it tonight from the candidates, I've heard it from the community, it doesn't feel like Park City in there. So when you come into our chambers, you should say, this feels like Park City. This culture in here is us. And then I see things moving forward.
With only two candidates, a primary election isn't necessary for the mayoral race. Ruben and Dickey have both been invited to share their views at a forum hosted by KPCW in the Park Record October 15th. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
In the studio now with an update from the Summit County Health Department, I have Director Phil Bondurant. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Let's first just start with some of the comments that were made in a column written by Ari Ioannidis, published in the July 12th Park Record. In that, he claimed that the cost per resident of services provided by the Summit County Health Department has increased from about $150 per person in 2021 to a projected $252 in 2025. So are these numbers correct? And if so, I mean, why has it increased $100 in 4 years?
Yeah, I want to say first, thank you for the opportunity to talk about the Summit County Health Department staff and the amazing work that they do. Oftentimes our work is behind the scenes. So anytime we have a platform like this monthly to address questions and concerns or even thoughts about the health department and the way we're funded, it's a great opportunity to do that. And those numbers that are put in there, there's a number of different factors. Absolutely, the number has increased over the last 4 years, but so has the involvement of the health department in the community. When we look back at 2021, which we can call the COVID era, if that's what we want to do, we can call it for what it is. There was growth in the department, but that growth occurred under a separate budgetary, I guess we'll call it category, with the COVID funds. We did not build any capacity or ongoing programming with that COVID funding, which is why when the last bit of that funding was taken back by President Trump earlier this year, unfortunately, we had to let the staff that was connected to that go. Now, that increase that's referenced in the article is, or the growth is connected to our, what we're putting towards our behavioral health services, and the growth that we've seen there and the demand that aligned with the council's strategic objectives around behavioral health and providing services. We've also seen an increase in our sustainability department, which is when sustainability was put under the public health umbrella, and we have Emily Quinton and Megan Nick in our sustainability department that are doing really good things in the community. And so when we look at that collectively as growth in our budget, yeah, we're a cross-cutting department that has influence on all aspects of health, whether that's community health, physical health, environmental health, or mental health. We're doing a lot of different things that traditional public health departments don't do. The last element that is definitely worth considering is the effectiveness of how our staff have gone out and aggressively sought grants focused on doing some of this work. So yes, the overall budget is definitely increased, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that entire increase is shouldered by tax dollars or local tax dollars. Some of that is fees, it's revenues, it's inspection permits, and then of course there's grants associated with that as well. So the number of staff have grown in the health department, but so have the expectations from the community and the work that we're doing that aligns with our mission and vision, the things that we're focused on around our community health improvement process and plan, community health assessment, and then of course supporting and aligning with the county council.
Okay, so now that some of that COVID era money has dried up, also the increase, as you mentioned, with additional duties of the health department, will we see the department budget go down something closer to 2021, I guess, adjusted for inflation and that increased responsibility?
Right now, I think the budget is built in a way that the combination of local tax dollars and grants, fees, revenues supports exactly what our current elected council would want out of the Summit County Health Department. As we work through our council, through our Board of Health, we're doing those things that our elected officials want done in this community. As a result of that, you see the funding that aligns with those expectations, those objectives, and those really the strategy to improve or at least maintain health here in Summit County. Now, as we see elected officials and seats change, there's always an opportunity to be fiscally responsible. It's a principle that I truly appreciate and enjoy discussing, because we want to make sure that whatever the council determines is their priority in this community, the health department is going to support that. And the council has always been very open to the idea that if there is something that they want to take on, the one that comes to mind most currently is sustainability, they're gonna fund that, and that's going to increase the bottom line in the health department. So absolutely, there's an opportunity, especially with current elections, some of the things that are changing in our council around state mandates and legislation, that there could be an opportunity to reevaluate that budget. But my hope is that anytime we do that and those objectives or initiatives from our council and our Board of Health change, whether they're reduced services or increased, that the budget would align with those expectations.
Well, we're in preliminary budget discussions at this point. So
correct.
What is it that you're asking for? I mean, will we see cuts, or are we going to see status quo here?
For the budget that is being proposed currently to the budget committee, and then to Shane, and then ultimately the council, the health department has had a level budget from 2024, the budget that we're currently operating in, or excuse me, 2025, the budget we're operating in now, to 2026 is a level budget. And so we've set aside money to focus on our community health improvement plan, which was a community-centric process that we held in June with many key stakeholders in our community, identifying public health shortfalls or blind spots that we have in the community that these stakeholders who are well-connected within their individual organizations helped us understand where we would allocate resources to improve those outcomes.
All right, moving on with the start of school this month, what do parents need to know?
Yeah, school is starting in a week or two, depending on where you're at. And for us at the health department, that's exciting. There's always back-to-school immunizations that start to pick up for our kindergartners and our seventh graders. But this year has a little bit different flair to it, and I think that's because of what has happened over the summer in the state of Utah around measles. Currently, we have 11 cases of measles. And as we step into the school year, we anticipate that there's a chance that we could find measles in one of our three public school districts or any of our charter or private schools. And in public health, I'll be the first to admit that we plan for the worst and work backwards. We always plan for what the worst case scenario could be and then begin working backwards towards reality using the data that are available to us. To get ahead of this, we had the unique opportunity to meet with our three superintendents from our public school systems, as well as Wileman, and really get ahead of the measles messaging, understanding roles and responsibilities. We have two newer superintendents, and then our superintendent out in South Summit, Greg, is he was here through COVID, or at least part of it. But Wade and Lindsay have been absolutely fantastic to work with. Where they're taking their individual districts is really encouraging, and they have proven early on to be partners with public health. And while we don't want anybody's lives to be impacted by illness, especially preventable illness, there is an opportunity for us to better message, both in English and Spanish, expectations around measles, what will happen if a measles case pops up in schools. And as a result, we have a lot of those things that we learned through the COVID response, I guess, figured out ahead of time in terms of communications, collaboration, regulation, response, responsibilities. The measles plan is derived from the state, and we follow that closely. And after having conversations with our school partners, we all are in agreement of how we want to move forward should we have a measles case pop up in Summit County.
Okay, so far so good.
Correct.
What's the latest on the RFQ? I think that was a request for quotation for behavioral health services.
Yeah, and first I want to apologize because last month on the air I corrected you and I was incorrect. It is actually requests for qualifications, not quotes. So my apologies on that. But that is an ongoing effort that's being driven by Aaron Newman in our behavioral health department or division. And what it does is it helps build a comprehensive list of services in extreme circumstances that are beyond the services or the capabilities of our local HMHI team or Huntsman's Mental Health Institute team. And so ongoing, we build this network of providers. And as a result, we've had a few individuals that we've added to our list that we can, in times of really difficult situations, we can call on. And we don't have to go through the process of getting everything in line and get a contract signed. Aaron can simply call the right people for the right situation. It's a really proactive way to managing behavioral health during difficult times for families, whether that's youth, adults, or senior citizens. This is a really unique way of approaching it, and I think it has proven to be effective in the last few months.
Okay. Let's see. Any notable results from the blood lead testing that was done at Farmers Market last month? Or did you have anybody stop by?
Yeah. Surprisingly, we had a really good showing. We had the Department of Environmental Quality up here to test the soils. We had the Department of Health and Human Services up here to help with some information. And then we had our nursing staff out there doing some blood lead level testing. And while we haven't had anybody surpass the action level of 5 micrograms per deciliter, which is good news, we have had some soils come back positive for lead. And as part of that event, we were able to provide education, awareness. Individuals now know what to look for, how they can maybe remediate their gardens or their backyards to reduce that lead. You know, there is a threshold of that 5 micrograms per deciliter is what's considered a high lead or an actionable case, but we don't want lead in our blood at all. It's not a naturally occurring element inside of our blood. So it's been a great event. We've had a high uptake of the blood screenings, both at that event and in the office. And it's really brought some awareness to the testing elements that we have and the opportunities and help people better understand their individual situations and the risks that are posed by the environment.
Yeah, so where does that reporting go? And the reason I ask, because you're well aware that Park City Municipal Corp has an agreement with the Environmental Protection Agency that there will be a clean cover of at least 6 inches on everybody's lawn within the Soils Protection Ordinance. So, I mean, the fact that you found some of that lead in somebody's yard, does that then get reported?
Yeah, the Department of Environmental Quality keeps a list of that. They do these events pretty regularly throughout the summer, lots of farmers markets or other community events, and they do keep a record of it. Because that is at the level of the EPA and it's inside of an agreement between Park City and the EPA, we don't get involved too much in the actual reporting for the environmental aspect. Now, if it finds its way into a person, especially a child, that's when we get involved and it becomes a reportable disease at that point. And we receive immediate notification. We have certified inspectors and evaluators on staff. Our nursing staff extremely aware of what goes on and through the testing element, but we're more involved on the human side as not so much on the environmental side.
Right. So the DEQ has that location information?
Yes, they take down all that information, they analyze it with their equipment, and then give the readout to the individual that brought the soil in, and then add that to their database.
And my understanding is that lead in the soil, not a great thing, but it's not a dangerous thing unless, in fact, somebody were to ingest the dirt?
Yeah, generally speaking, your day-to-day interactions with your backyard are not, if you did have lead present in your yard, it's not going to create the concern as if, you know, you hear about the paint chips or lead pipes and those types of things. But it's still, you know, if you've got a garden back there and you're using that soil for your garden, there is some evidence that the vegetables might take in some of that lead is throughout the growing season. And the best way to combat that is knowledge. And all we can do is educate individuals. They can go through and swap out soils. They can work with Park City Municipal inside of their agreement with the EPA to understand what is or is not allowed or what is or is not provided. But that's all through knowledge and education, and that's really what we're here for.
All right. Moving on, of course, there's been the Basin Cemetery, Centerville Basin Cemetery Commission has kind of taken a step back, but you have also told me you're not involved in the location of a new Centerville Basin Cemetery. But the health department is involved with the proposed Oakley Green Cemetery. So what's the difference here?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's a really unique situation. The basin conversation we're involved in just generally through the internal permitting process. Our environmental health team would have the opportunity to weigh in inside of existing code, both state and local code around the siting of a cemetery. We would want to know, are there elements of groundwater intrusion? How is that going to impact our groundwater, our environment, those types of things. The Green Cemetery in Oakley is interesting because there are no rules. There's no code, ordinance, legislation around what can or cannot be from a green cemetery. So our involvement in that was Mayor Wolstenholme reached out and asked if, because we were involved in that world, in the environment, and what we do around septic and wastewater and soil analysis, if we would be willing to partner or at least be a part of that conversation about what some of the environmental risks might be. We held no regulatory authority inside of that conversation. We were simply there as a partner or a friend providing our opinion on what may or may not come from a green burial cemetery. So there's a little difference there. One is heavily regulated. The other is a blooming idea. It's a new idea. It's something that somebody is really interested in. Oakley City is doing their best to evaluate it, and we've just been able to be a part of that evaluation.
So again, if the health department's not regulating burial grounds, who is in the county?
I believe that's through a planning element. When they site a cemetery like that, it has to be inside of the development code, and it goes to the planning commissions and those types of individuals, groups. Our environmental health team has a sign-off block on all of the permits that go through the county, whether it's a home, a restaurant, what have you. But in this case, the Snyderville conversation is nothing outside of what the normal processes are for our environmental health team.
Okay. Earlier in the season, summer, I had seen, I think it was a press release from the Summit County Health Department talking about bats, specifically the problem bats cause with rabies. And what was that, just a warning to people, to kind of a PSA?
Yeah, we have, in public health, we have a love-hate relationship with bats, because bats on one hand are a great natural predator of mosquitoes, which present a disease risk of their own, but on the other hand, they tend to carry disease of their own as well. And as we get into this time of year where the days are longer, well, now we're starting to see the days shorten a little bit, but the days are longer, the nights are a little bit warmer, the mosquitoes are more active, which then means the bats are more active, and they're in a migratory pattern. As a result of that, they tend to find areas where they don't normally hold up for the night or for the season, in an effort to just do their thing. And as a result of that, we see a lot more human exposures, or at least the potential for human exposures related to bats. Now, the greatest risk of a bat is rabies. I think that's a well-known element of contact with bats. And we are, again, in the business of educating and helping individuals understand that if you feel you've been exposed to a bat, we want to take every precaution necessary. We want to treat every bat as though it has rabies, because rabies is 100% fatal. There's no coming back from rabies. And so we always encourage individuals that if you are exposed to a bat, most of the time we hear people wake up in a cabin or somewhere and there's a bat in the room. Do not kill the bat if you can. You don't want to kill the bat. You definitely don't want to get rid of the bat, because we can have that bat tested for rabies. If the bat is caught and then released into the wild and you're found that you have a scratch or a bite, most likely we're going to have to explore the idea of the rabies shots, the vaccine immunization shots of rabies, which is expensive, it's painful, it's timely. However, if we can catch the bat, throw a blanket over it, get a hold of animal control, do something to keep the bat in our presence, there are ways to keep it cool. You know, we've had them show up in Cool Whip containers at the office, where somebody put the Cool Whip container over the top of it, got the lid on it, put it in the fridge, not the freezer. We don't want to freeze it, just keep it cool. And we've been able to successfully determine whether that bat did or did not have rabies, and then set the proper course of action from there.
So if you kill it, why can't you test it after the fact?
You can. Oh. You absolutely can. A lot of times, as people react, they'll kill the bat with a broom, knock it down, and then they will continue to stomp on it. And that makes it really difficult, because we need to be able to test the brains and run it through some tests. And so we don't want to, you know, smash it to smithereens per se. We want to keep it as intact as possible. So if you do use a broom or something along that line to knock the bat off, and it does kill the bat, then we can still do it. We don't want to take those extreme measures in killing the bat, so we can test it.
Okay. And finally, I just wanted to quickly ask you about, you had some note of a harmful algal bloom popping up. Where are these showing up?
Yeah, this is the time of year where we start to see in our reservoirs, it's been hot long enough, the water isn't turning over as much as it does in other times of the year, so the temperature increases and we have blue-green algae, better known as harmful algal blooms, pop up in a few of our reservoirs. To date, we have not seen that in Summit County. They are being tested regularly. Our environmental health team works closely with the Department of Environmental Quality, and we also take in complaints from the community or a heads up from the community that there's that blue-green shimmery sheen, and it's present. We'll run out, we'll take a look, get the process started, and then, of course, through our channels, work through Department of Natural Resources, the individual reservoirs, to get notification out and help people be as safe as they can.
Okay, Phil, talk to you next month. Thanks.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Phil Bondurant, director of the Summit County Health Department. The V Foundation, Victory Over Cancer, is hosting an event later this month to raise money for cancer research. In the studio with details, I have organizer Nancy Major. Good morning, Nancy.
Good morning, Leslie. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so for those unfamiliar, can you briefly share what the V Foundation is and how the Victory Over Cancer initiative kind of fits into your mission?
Yes, sure. Thank you for the opportunity. The V Foundation was started by Jim Valvano, the NC State basketball coach, national champion in 1983. And after they won the national championship, he became an ESPN commentator. In 1993, 10 years after the championship, he was diagnosed with metastatic cancer, so cancer that had already spread throughout his body by the time he was diagnosed. And while he was getting his care then at Duke Hospital in North Carolina, he had a conversation with a researcher who told him that a lot of the great ideas that she had and her colleagues had couldn't get funding. And so he made a commitment with ESPN, which now is the famous ESPY speech that he gave. He was the first recipient of the Arthur Ashe Humanitarian Award at the ESPYs in 1993. And his speech announced the partnership between ESPN and the Jimmy V Foundation for Cancer Research, now called the V Foundation for Cancer Research. And that the entire purpose of the foundation is to raise money so that these young, talented researchers have the opportunity to test their theory and allow that research to develop where they can then achieve additional funding from larger institutions like the NIH or American Cancer Society, so on.
Yeah, so this is a national organization then?
It is a national organization where the monies raised and the recipients, the grant recipients, are at any of the 72 national cancer institutes around the country and in North America.
Yeah. So what brought you to the V Foundation? What inspired your personal commitment here?
My personal commitment became an invitation from Coach Mike Krzyzewski, who was the Duke basketball coach at the time that I was on faculty at Duke. And he asked me to attend the first V Foundation, a large celebration. It was a wine celebration in Napa, California. And I was hooked after that. And that was 22 years ago.
All right. And so you've got a fundraiser that's happening here locally?
Yes. So on the 21st of August, at my home, we're hosting an event to raise additional funds for the V Foundation.
All right. So give us a little bit more details. I mean, what do people need to know and how to buy a ticket?
Sure. The best way to purchase a ticket is nancy.major1@gmail.com. And the event is the 21st of August, starting at 6 p.m. And 100% of all donations goes directly to the V Foundation. And I do want to reinforce that point. The V Foundation is one of the very few foundations where 100% of the donations go directly to cancer research. We have no overhead. The foundation is very well endowed, so we can say that everything that you give gets turned around and goes directly to cancer research. So in the last 32 years of the charity, $400 million has been distributed in cancer research. And for those who have a very savvy business sense, that $400 million has turned into additional $20 billion in cancer research funding. So that means that our grant recipients are able to achieve additional grant funding from larger institutions.
Tell me, is there a particular focus of with the funds?
That's a great question. And the V Foundation funds all kinds of cancers in all demographics. So from pediatrics to adult, any type of cancer. So we're not focused specifically, for example, on breast cancer or pancreatic cancer or prostate cancer. We focus on all different kinds of cancers and are learning through this incredible research from our very talented scientists that there's a lot of crossover and that there's some interesting work being done in one area that can correlate to interest in other areas as well.
So these research foundations, and they apply for funding from you?
Yes.
From the V Foundation, not you, but...
Yeah. Yes, the interested researcher with a terrific idea will then apply for will put her or his ideas together, and then within that local institution will apply for a grant. And typically there are other equally as excited researchers who are applying. And one will get selected from that institution. And then that gets forwarded to the V Foundation Scientific Advisory Committee. And all of those grants then get evaluated the way that an NIH grant would get evaluated, very rigorously. And only the best of the best actually achieve funding. So in the situation that we have this year, for example, we had five more grants that qualified in the scoring to receive funding, but are looking for more funding to be able to fund those grants. So it's a very competitive process, and we obviously choose the best of the best by the numbers that I've just mentioned earlier.
So any great results to report given as a result of some V Foundation funding?
Yes. So in the 32 years of the foundation, the patients with cancer diagnoses are living a minimum of 10 years longer. A third of patients are living 10 years longer than they did 30 years ago. So I think that's pretty exciting news.
Yeah. Talk to me a little bit about the 4% of funding and the impact on research. There's some formula for that, huh?
Well, what has happened with the recent decisions in Washington, 96% of funding has been cut. So that leaves only 4%, which is roughly about $400 million, to be distributed for all kinds of research. So there's an opportunity here for the public to truly step up and help to bridge that gap. We obviously can't afford to have cancer research come to a halt, any research for that matter, that's making great progress. And so keeping this going is very important for the public to be aware that they can play an important role in helping to continue our funding for cancer research.
Okay, so this fundraiser coming up on the 21st, tickets are how much?
$150 per person.
Okay, and that includes what?
Well, for that evening, they'll get a lot of entertainment. So our host, in fact, is Thurl Bailey, who played on Jim Valvano's national championship team in 1983, and as you all know, is the voice of the Jazz and analyst. So we're very, very excited to have Thurl present for this event. We're being catered by Rebecca's Kitchen here in Park City, so exciting. So some excellent food, music provided by Matt Fry. And then we'll have an auction for the evening, as well as an opportunity to give directly to the Cancer Foundation.
And if people, individuals or organizations, want to get involved and can't attend in person, I mean, how can they help?
The best way is to reach out personally to me at Nancy, N-A-N-C-Y, dot Major, M-A-J-O-R, number one, at Gmail. And I would be able to answer questions, put people in the right direction, and even help those who are looking for opportunities for their own cancer journey to have some questions answered.
Okay. Do you have a Facebook page or anything online that people can look at?
Yes, v.org is the best way to get additional information about everything that the foundation is doing, including those who have been funded previously and the results of their research.
Awesome. Okay. Anything else, Nancy, you want to tell us?
No, I would just love to see as many people there on the 21st so we can continue to spread the word on the good that the foundation is doing and how people can help in this time of kind of crisis for funding.
Okay. Nancy, thanks for your time.
Leslie, thank you.
Nancy Major, again, is one of the organizers of the Victory Over Cancer for the V Foundation, the fundraiser happening August 21st. To mark their 30th anniversary, Peace House has gone through a brand refresh. In the studio with an update, I have the executive director of Peace House, Kendra Wyckoff. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So why was it important to mark the anniversary this way?
Well, we have, we have 30 years, three decades of providing safety, healing, and hope in the community. And from our early stages as a grassroots emergency shelter in 1995 to where we've grown today as a comprehensive organization offering just a whole continuum of services, including sexual assault services, we felt like it was just a really great opportunity and milestone to make some shifts in our branding and messaging that better represented our entire mission as a whole.
So what was more of kind of a lotus flower with an individual raising their arms, we've turned into a dove?
Yes, yeah. It's kind of an origami bird. What's interesting is that one of the first logos that Peace House used was a dove, if folks remember way back when we were the Domestic Peace Task Force. So it's a little bit of a nod to the history of the past, but it really is looking towards the future. And when we went through this process, what we found is that this particular design really represented to us a lightness, freedom, the ability to take flight, all things that we equate to our mission and the work that we do with survivors, giving them the opportunity to have safety, to heal, to rebuild their lives. And I had actually one staff member say to me, and I just love the way that she said this. She said, you know, with an origami bird, you know, you create something from a piece of paper. And oftentimes survivors are creating or recreating a life that is violence-free from just the raw resources that they have in their life when they leave an abusive relationship. So it's a beautiful, you know, recognition of the process that survivors go through in creating a life that they're looking to that is different than the one that they left.
So looking back 30 years, 1995, I mean, what was it that the Peace House offered? I mean, did you have the facility on MARSAC at that point?
We did. That's when it opened in 1995. The emergency shelter opened over here on MARSAC. So the small little red house, 5 bedrooms, you know, 3 bathrooms. And that was, you know, the start of what Peace House was offering survivors in the community, an opportunity to have a safe place, because we had 2 terrible tragedies in the past in the early 90s, and it was the biggest concern at the time is that women and children needed a safe place to go.
And I wanted to bring that up because that was, as I recall, it was that Peace House really gained traction when it was really the cold-blooded shooting of Natalie Noble,
yes,
by her husband, and then the strangling death of Patty Blanchard by her husband. And I don't think we've seen anything like that since, which is a great thing.
Right. I mean, certainly we are in the business of helping people rebuild their lives, but ultimately we are trying to prevent the worst possible outcome when it comes to domestic violence, and that is domestic violence homicide.
Yeah. We often think of Peace House helping those involved in domestic violence situations, but you also help those who may be in a trafficking situation. Can you talk to us? I mean, how often does that happen?
Yeah, well, it happens more often than you would think. Human trafficking is an issue that often looks like domestic violence in our communities. Perpetrators of human trafficking utilize some of the very same dynamics that an abusive partner will use, power and control. And they basically isolate an individual and then utilize them. Most frequently we see for sex trafficking, but on occasion we do see labor trafficking as well. And in those circumstances, when people are living in the same household with an individual who is abusing them, we can provide services and support to them.
Yeah, in a situation at home, somebody can walk away, right? I mean, it may not be easy, but can. In a trafficking situation, it's not as easy, though, is it?
No, I think that, you know, either situation, there can be a lot of complexity, really, depending upon the different barriers that folks may have, survivors may have. So if somebody is undocumented, that is a threat that is used frequently, whether it's with an abusive partner or with somebody who's perpetrating human trafficking on another person. You know, it's very scary to think that that person may call the police or get ICE involved. If there are children involved, you know, threatening to take the kids because somebody doesn't have their legal status, taking their passports and hiding all of their documentation so that they can't leave if they are here in the country legally, but they don't have their documentation. It makes it very difficult. Lots of threats of coercion and fear. And oftentimes, you know, there's that element that I will, if you don't stay with me, I will hunt you down and I will kill you. And that is a very strong reason why many survivors choose to stay in the situation and not be able to leave, because they're very fearful of what will happen if they do leave.
So over the 30 years, any idea how many victims have been helped?
Oh, thousands, thousands. If you think on average, just in the 8 years that I have been here, we have been serving between 500 and 600 survivors that we know of, right? People who are actually engaging in services and share information with us. But we take usually 2,000 helpline calls a year. So those are people that we're touching as well in different ways. We might just be introducing information to them for the very first time through the helpline. But I would say, you know, after 30 years, we're probably in the tens of thousands at this point, people that we have touched and provided direct services to. And then really with the youth education and prevention work, you know, on average, we get in front of 10 to 12,000 students a year. So the impact that we have has had an incredible ripple effect.
So as part of the 30th anniversary celebration, Peace House plans to share 30 stories for 30 years, honoring their individuals, the donors, and advocates who have helped shape its mission. Tell me about the project.
Yeah, so this is really going to be an opportunity to share the stories of the past 30 years from survivors, from donors, from board members, from community members and leaders who've been involved with Peace House, to really highlight the impact that the organization has had on them and their lives and the contributions that they have made. It will be a social media campaign that we'll be utilizing, and we'll also be having an open house on October 25th. to highlight the 30th anniversary, but also just to really open up the doors and again create accessibility to our community so people can understand what resources and services that we have. Because at the forefront, that's the most critical thing, is that people understand what we are offering in this community, how they can connect others or themselves to that resource, so that we can ensure that individuals who are affected by these issues are getting the help that they need.
So how do people share their stories?
Yeah, you can reach out to our Director of Marketing and Communications, Erica Carlson, and her email's real simple. It's erica@peacehouse.org. If you go to our website, you can find her there as well. In tandem with this logo launch at the end of August, we'll have a new website too. So hopefully that will be easier to navigate. We've had a lot of great feedback over the years on the fact that there have been some things that are easy to find and things that are harder to find. And we want to make sure again that in all forms that we can be as accessible as possible as an organization.
All right. Last time we spoke, you were concerned about funding from the state. How did that all work out?
Yeah, so we did see some cuts in our funding for this next fiscal year, and that certainly is going to have an impact on the organization. We are looking to some additional resources. Obviously, we'll be ramping up our special events and our fundraising opportunities in the community. You know, as an organization, we've grown extensively over the years. Our budget is nearing $5 million, and it's really critical that we can continue to sustain these services. We know that the impact has been vital for safety, vital for healing. We've seen amazing outcomes with our transitional housing program. We've launched into our children's services, and we're providing respite care for families now on our campus so that children are getting the support that they need. So it's really important to have the community step up and help us out during this time. And you'll be hearing more about that as we roll out more of our 30th anniversary. We're encouraging people to give, you know, to celebrate that as well.
Yeah. So you've been in the new facility for how long?
We've been in the new facility for 6 years, which is just unbelievable. Time flies.
Yeah, and certainly while the goal is that you don't need it, I mean, are you finding that it's still meeting your needs?
Well, I think that that's such a great question. We find that we are at capacity almost every day. We find that, you know, we have had to expand our staff to be able to meet the needs, not just of those that are living on our campus, but about half the people we serve are living in the community. So not everybody needs shelter or transitional housing. And I think that as we continue to see this community grow, as we continue to expand our awareness efforts, and the fact that we have been this publicly disclosed facility that really has increased accessibility, we're going to see that the needs are going to continue to grow. And oftentimes people think, well, is that because domestic violence is, you know, the rates are increasing? At the heart of it, it's really complex and multifaceted. Some of it could be that. But what we know is that when there's more awareness in a community, more people are going to reach out. When people feel like there's an opportunity and an option and a resource, more people are going to reach out for help.
Yeah, and you serve the Wasatch back here.
We do. We serve both Summit and Wasatch County.
Yeah, so are you seeing funding from Wasatch County?
We get a little bit of funding over from our Wasatch County friends, and we would certainly love to, you know, talk with them more about support in the future. We saw a 100% increase in the number of people coming from Wasatch County year over year last year. So we had about 80 individuals seeking services 2 years ago. Last year it was 160. So it's significant, and we know that we've done a lot of outreach in that community. We've worked really alongside a lot of the local government officials who've done a fantastic job of ensuring that we have the places to talk about the resources that we offer and getting the information out to citizens.
Okay. Kendra, anything else you wanted to mention about what you're doing?
Well, again, just want to remind everybody that October 25th will be our open house, and October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, so please join us for any other events that we have out there. And of course, if you or someone you know is needing help, please reach out to our helpline or come to our campus. Our helpline number is available 24 hours a day at 1-800-647-9161.
Okay. Kendra, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks so much, Leslie.
Kendra Wyckoff is the Executive Director of Peace House.